From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Franco's ghosts. Today, a look at the scandal that has rocked the International Olympic Committee and its chief, Juan Antonio Samaranch, a former fascist official in Franco's Spain. Also, four Plowshares activists are arrested after early yesterday morning hammering on Warthog planes, which fired depleted uranium in both Iraq during the Persian Gulf War and Yugoslavia. Phil Berrigan among them. We'll get the latest. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. International peacekeepers in East Timor today found the remains of more than two dozen bodies in two mass burial sites they fear may contain more than 100 victims killed by anti-independence militia gangs and Indonesian troops. Australian Navy divers have recovered the remains of about a dozen bodies that were apparently dumped in a lake at Malbara, 7 miles west of the coastal town of Lekisa. More were feared to be buried there. They're believed to be the victims of a bloody April 6th attack on parishioners at Lekisa's main Roman Catholic church. This according to Yayasan Hak, a Timorese human rights group, which claimed a total of 67 people were shot or hacked to death by soldiers and thugs belonging to local militia gang. International peacekeepers said they believe many or all of those killed in the church attack may have been buried together in the lake. East Timor's leader, Xanana Gusmão, arrived Saturday with the Portuguese Prime Minister, Antonio Guterres, for celebrations to mark Macau's return to Chinese rule and voiced gratitude for the enclave's help during the recent troubles in East Timor. Macau and East Timor, which was under Portuguese rule until 1975, have had close links over the years, and Macau provided a haven for many East Timorese escaping the Indonesian occupation. Yes, China took control of the tiny southern enclave of Macau, ending 442 years of Portuguese rule and closing an era of European colonialism in China. In this news from St. Martinville, Louisiana, the State Department says the Cuban detainees who surrendered peacefully after holding hostages at a jail for nearly a week will be sent back to Cuba. Five Cubans and one person from the Bahamas gave up late Saturday at the St. Martin Parish Jail, freeing the warden, a female guard, and five female inmates. The standoff began December 13th by prisoners who demanded to be released from the South Central Louisiana jail and sent to another country. The Cubans were being held indefinitely in a state of legal limbo, although they had committed no crime. Before the surrender, the U.S. government wouldn't release them because it considered them subject to deportation, and the Cuban government would not take them back. After weekend negotiations, Cuba agreed to take the Cubans. In the second major drug merger in as many months, Monsanto Corporation and Pharmacia and Upjohn are combining their medicine cabinets to create the world's 11th largest pharmaceutical company. The two companies signed an agreement yesterday to merge their operations, which together had 1999 revenues of $17 billion, driven by sales of blockbuster treatments for arthritis and glaucoma. The combined company will have a research budget of $2 billion and a broader sales force to push each other's drugs. The new company's pharmaceutical business will be headquartered in Peapack, New Jersey, where Pharmacia is based, and the agricultural chemical business will be headquartered in Monsanto's hometown of St. Louis. Venezuela's First Lady opened the presidential residence to children feared orphaned by flooding and mudslides that have killed at least 5,000 people. Upon arriving at the home yesterday, survivor Fira Lopez pleaded to Marisabel Chavez, the wife of President Hugo Chavez, for help in finding her three-month-old sister. Then she fainted in Chavez's arms. 35 children were at the presidential residence yesterday, about a third of them mentally retarded youngsters rescued from a care facility that was submerged by the floods. There are about 25,000 people missing and 150,000 homeless after the torrential rains and mudslides that struck the north coast and the capital of Caracas last week. Blocked roads and communications disruptions are hampering aid efforts and damage assessments. President Chavez appealed for help in coping with the disaster, Venezuela's worst this century. In this news from Russia, exit polls and preliminary results showed reformers and centrists doing well in races for 450 Duma seats. And while communists held their ground, the center of gravity appeared to be shifting toward groups likely to support the Kremlin. Russian artillery, meanwhile, pounded Grozny, Chechnya, as armored forces probed the city from three directions. As usual, Moscow has provided little information on the scope of the assault. And that's some of the news at this hour. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Early Sunday morning at about 4 o'clock, four Plowshares activists entered the Warfield Air National Guard Base in Essex, Maryland, and began to hammer on two A-10 Thunderbolt planes known as Warthogs. The activists are Phil Berrigan, Susan Crane, the Reverend Steve Kelly, and Elizabeth Waltz. They hammered on the gun placed on the nose of one warplane on the wings and poured blood into the plane's engines. They also unfurled a banner on the planes that read Plowshares versus Depleted Uranium. The activists say they targeted these planes because they fired 95% of the depleted uranium used by the United States in the Gulf War. They also fired on Yugoslavia. They were arrested and are being arraigned today. We now go to Jonah House in Baltimore, Maryland, where Phil Berrigan lives, and we speak to Elizabeth McAllister, a spokesperson for the group, before she heads off to the arraignments today. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Liz McAllister.
Thank you, Amy, very much.
Well, can you elaborate a little further on exactly what took place early in the morning yesterday?
I can tell you that we have heard from Philip and Susan. And they told us that they divided into two groups of two. Philip worked with Liz Walls, and Susan Crane worked with Steve Kelly, the Jesuit priest, on two separate A-10 Warthogs. And they started by hammering on the Gatling gun that comes out of the nose of the planes, and then hammered on the pylons underneath the wings, and then poured their blood into the engines of the planes. Steve Kelly climbed on the wing of the plane he was working on and managed to pry back the vinyl covering and pour his blood right into the engine before they were stopped by security. They also hung their banner, I gather, on the planes, though I don't have a clear picture of that. And then they were arrested by security. That would be Federal Air Security. That's what we know. And since that point, they have been in the system, and I have not spoken to Philip since about 6 o'clock yesterday morning. It's my sense he has not even seen a commissioner yet, nor has Steve Kelly. The women have seen a commissioner, have been transported to the Baltimore County Detention Center, and today they will go for a bail reduction hearing.
Do you know,
Amy, that's what I know.
Do you know what they have been charged, what they will be charged with?
I have a sense of what the women are charged with because they have already been charged. They're charged with trespass, with malicious destruction of property value, with burglary, third degree, a felony, and burglary, fourth degree. Susan is, in addition, charged with assault. It seems that Susan and Steve did not respond quickly enough to the order to desist and get down on the ground. Steve was sprayed with pepper spray. He was up on the wing or up somewhere on the plane. Susan was on the ground, and they tackled her. So tackling her amounted to her assaulting them, I guess. That's, in terms of Philip and Steve, I can only imagine that their charges will be similar, if not exactly the same. Though without the assault charge for Philip and Liz, I don't know how they could charge Steve with assault for being pepper sprayed, but who knows?
I should also say that Liz McAllister is married to Philip Berrigan, who was involved in this action. Liz McAllister herself, Plowshares activist, was imprisoned for a similar action in the 1980s. How much time did you serve, Liz?
For that Plowshares witness?
Yes.
It was a three-year sentence. I maxed out after 25 months.
Mm-hmm. Now, Philip Berrigan only, well, recently came out of prison for another action. So what will that mean in terms of the charges for him? Our regular listeners might remember when Jeremy Scahill and I went down to the Virginia prison where he was incarcerated and did an interview with him. I guess it was last St. Patrick's Day.
Okay. Philip was released November 20th, 1998, so he's been home just over a year, 25 months. It applies as well to Steve and Susan, though. Both of them were part of the Prince of Peace Plowshares at the Bath Iron Works in Maine. Steve served like 25 months and Susan 24. Susan was released in February of this year and Steve in March of this year. All three are on probation, supervised probation for 2 years. Steve, as it turns out, had never reported to a probation officer. So all of them face probation violation for this action on top of the consequences of this action itself.
Hmm. Elizabeth McCall.
That does not apply to Liz Walls. To my knowledge, this is the first such action she has done.
Elizabeth McAllister, can you explain, for listeners who are not familiar with these Plowshares actions, why specifically did they target the warthogs now, but also what this whole activity is about, pouring their own blood, hammering with household hammers?
Uh-huh. Well, they targeted, let me take the first question first, they targeted the warthog because of the depleted uranium. And in the statement that they left behind, they begin it by saying, attack a village with an A-10 warthog and leave a trench. Attack a village with an A-10 warthog firing depleted uranium and leave a poisoned graveyard, the people dead, plants dying or sterile, the earth finally toxic. So I know, living with Philip and Susan, she's a member of the Jonah House community, that depleted uranium has been a source of profound anguish for them. And the way we have talked about it is that we not only used nuclear weapons in Japan in 1945, but we have waged another nuclear war in Iraq and another one in former Yugoslavia. And that dimension is not getting the kind of focus that the outrage of nuclear weapons deserves. That's what they've been walking with in their own consciousness, and that's why they chose the warthog. Because it is, as you said yourself in introducing this, 95% of the of the depleted uranium deployed during the Gulf War was deployed through these planes. In terms of the Plowshares actions, the mandate comes out of the prophecies of Isaiah and of Micah to beat swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. And that was first embodied in 1980 in the Plowshares Age. And there have since been upwards of 70 Plowshares actions inspired by the prophecy of Isaiah using the basic symbols of hammer and blood. Hammer is a basic household tool. You use it to tear down and to build up. and thus to hammer, is that urge to convert these weapons of mass destruction into things that are serviceable to life. And the blood is a basic biblical symbol. In fact, one of the most powerful of biblical symbols. And it reaffirms the covenant with Jesus, a covenant sealed in the blood of Jesus. And it stresses the prohibition against killing. Blood also contains a lot of salt, and blood in the engines of those planes are apt to be comparable to sugar in the gas tank. Is that helpful, Amy? Do you want to pull that
certainly,
further?
Yeah, that certainly explains it. I'm also looking at some documents that have been put out by the Plowshares activists talking about depleted uranium and its effects. And
yep.
We mentioned Yugoslavia and Iraq, and they go on to talk not only about Yugoslavia and Iraq, but also to talk about Vieques and Okinawa as well, where depleted uranium has been shelled.
And one needs to as well focus on where it's being manufactured here in this country and where it's deployed and the incredible, the devastating effects of this substance. And the fact that the less outrage there is against the use of this, the more commonly used it's become. So we are literally giving and selling depleted uranium to other countries to use in their own weapons.
Elizabeth McAllister, we recently reported on the acquittal of Plowshares activists in Scotland who had hammered on the communication system of the nuclear Trident missile. Did this influence the decision of Philip Berrigan, Susan Crane, and the others to move ahead? Is there a hope?
I can't comment on that at all, Amy. You know, I don't pretend to stand inside their heads or know. I know what they were walking with in terms of a concern about depleted uranium, because that's a shared concern within the community. In terms of that decision influencing their action, I can't say. We certainly rejoice together over that acquittal for that reason. You know, an acquittal for reasons of technicalities is one thing. But an acquittal that says the Trident submarine is an unlawful weapon, it's a violation of international law in and of itself, well, we say alleluia to that kind of decision.
Now, rarely...
We don't expect that in this country, though.
Has there ever been a Plowshares action in this country where they have been allowed to use the international law defense and bring it into the trial?
The Gods of Metal Plowshares that acted at Andrews Air Force Base a year ago May, so that's a year and a half ago, were able to have testimony in court. Francis Boyle spoke about, gave testimony about international law and them not being criminal, but the air show itself and the weapons at that air show being the criminal. But the judge fairly well ignored and wrote it off. Out in Seattle, Washington, a judge allowed the evidence of international law in an action at Ground Zero, which is the Trident base out in Seattle, Puget Sound. That wasn't a Plowshares action as such, and it was state charges. And the defendants in that case were acquitted. But there is no history of Plowshares activists being acquitted on the basis of international law in this country.
And do you know offhand what number Plowshares action this is in this country?
I don't know offhand. I know we're pushing 70. Mm-hmm. But a specific number, I haven't done that research yet.
Yesterday was the fourth Sunday of Advent. What
Correct.
Is that?
Correct.
What is that?
Advent is the season. It's the beginning of Advent is the beginning of the church year, the liturgical year, and it's a period of preparation for the coming of the kingdom of God. and it's a period in which we are encouraged to wait, to watch, to hope, and to hope not just in a vacuum, but to hope in terms of action, to hope to bet our lives on the fact that we can be transformed, we can be changed, we can become loving sisters and brothers and loving toward this earth.
Well,
and that's the spirit in which I would understand that they act.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Elizabeth McAllister, spokesperson for the Plowshares Group, speaking us to Jonah from Jonah House, where she is now headed off to the arraignment of some of the Plowshares activists who were arrested yesterday. I guess this will be another Christmas for you where a number of members of your household will not be together. Again, latest news from yesterday morning. Philip Berrigan, Susan Crane, Reverend Steve Kelly, and Elizabeth Waltz arrested at the National Guard base in Essex, Maryland by Federal Air Police for disarming two warthogs. These planes are known for the firing of depleted uranium in the Persian Gulf War and also in Yugoslavia. Their action called Plowshares versus Depleted Uranium. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, Franco's Ghosts, a look at Juan Antonio Samaranch, the head of the International Olympic Committee, and the scandal that has rocked the international sports body. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As today we take a look at the career and past of a powerful man named Juan Antonio Samaranch. He is currently the head of the International Olympic Committee. Samaranch is credited with transforming the Olympic Committee from a bankrupt institution into a multi-billion-dollar commercial venture. But with the IOC's meteoric rise have also come charges of corruption and influence peddling in the awarding of the Olympics to Atlanta, Sydney, and Salt Lake City. It was a year ago last week that the Salt Lake City scandal, the vote-buying scandal, broke with damaging documents pointing to corruption being released. Today we're going to take a look at the man and the committee. And we're going to start off with a piece that appeared in the Wall Street Journal last December 7th, entitled Franco's Ghosts. For Mr. Samaranch, IOC's transformation has been his as well. It's written by several Wall Street Journal reporters, Craig Capetas, Carlta Vitzhum, and Roger Thoreau. And it starts like this. To understand the character of Juan Antonio Samaranch, the embattled president of the International Olympic Committee, turn the clock back to an April day 2 decades ago. A crowd of about 100,000 Catalans poured into Plaça Sant Joan that day to vent their anger at a prominent symbol of Spanish fascism. This was in Barcelona, Spain. Dictator Francisco Franco was dead, and Spain was preparing for its first democratic election since the 1930s. For some 40 years, the Franco regime had suppressed the Catalans' aspirations for autonomy. Now it was the feast of Saint Jordi, Catalonia's patron saint, and the Catalans were in no mood to compromise. Samaranch, get out, they shouted over and over on that sunny day in 1977. Samaranch, get out. It seemed like the end for Mr. Samaranch, one of the highest-ranking Catalan officials in Francoist Spain. But then, as now, Mr. Samaranch wasn't a man who likes to quit. Just 3 years later, after some deft political maneuvering that turned him into a diplomat representing a new democratic Spain, Samaranch was back in the spotlight, this time as the powerful president of the IOC. A man reviled by his fellow Catalans was striding atop the world of sports like a statesman, treading on red carpets in capitals and welcomed into the boardrooms of dozens of major corporations. In a remarkable transformation, Mr. Samaranch had swapped the blue camisa worn by ardent Francoists for the double-breasted finery of the IOC. Those were the opening paragraphs of the piece in the Wall Street Journal last December 7th. A few days later, Juan Samaranch was in Washington, D.C., sitting next to the former Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, and testifying before a House Commerce Subcommittee on the corruption of the IOC. We go right now to Paris, France, where Wall Street Journal reporter Craig Capetis is, to give us more background on just who Juan Antonio Samaranch is and why the Wall Street Journal is reporting on sports. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Craig Capetis.
Thank you.
So talk about how you got involved in the coverage of the IOC and Juan Antonio Samaranch, its head.
Well, in 1992, the Journal discovered that the Olympic Games were actually a multi-billion dollar business, currently valued at some $10 billion. And we decided to follow the Olympics as a business, as a corporation, as a management story, essentially, where the people who run the IOC and those who give the IOC the money were essentially our athletes and the ones we covered. So we've been at this for quite a long time. That's how it began.
And tell us about Juan Antonio Samaranch and your investigation of his past. I have to say it has not been easy to find people talking about him, in Spain in particular.
Well, the rumors of, everyone has known for years that Franco worked for the Franco, or, I mean that Samaranch worked for the Franco government, but what we discovered is that Samaranch had clearly obfuscated his involvement on many degrees. He testified in court in Switzerland a number of years ago in a lawsuit against a book that he was a minor official in the Franco regime like many others. And once during an interview with me, he had said the same thing. He was a minor bureaucrat, and he said, the people of Spain have embraced me, so this is only an issue for the people of Spain to decide. Well, we decided to take Mr. Samaranch up on his offer, and we spent about 5 months investigating this and discovered that what Mr. Samaranch was saying was actually quite far from the truth. He was clearly one of the leading Francoists in Spain in a very, very senior position. In fact, a number of senior positions, had the ear of Franco, was involved in the day-to-day activities of the Falange and the movement Tito, which was the amalgamation of Franco's chums and friends and unions and political cronies. He also sat in the rubber stamp parliament and was involved in legislation. He was not what he said he was. As far as his statements about his past with Franco, it's for my mind's eye, the most incredible thing was that a few hours after our story appeared, Samaranch was compelled into giving a press conference. And at that press conference, he re-embraced Franco. This was on December 7th of this year. He re-embraced Franco, which I found an incredible thing for someone to say at the turn of the century. And he called him a great man and said that Franco was very good for Spain. And then started to spew a number of what many historians will argue or were inaccuracies about what Franco actually did for Spain. That's really the story in a nutshell. His management of the IOC is, according to the historians and management experts we spoke to, all of whom, by the way, were Spanish. There was no Anglo-Saxon quoted in this story. One of Samaranch's criticisms of anyone who goes into his past is saying, well, the people of Spain are the only ones who can be the judge. Well, that's what we did. We went to Spain and we talked to the Spaniards. And frankly, they turned out to be more bitter and vitriolic towards him than I had ever seen in any Anglo-Saxon reports.
Well, actually, Craig Kopetis, we are going to go to one of the people that you interviewed who is currently in Barcelona. He is Josep Benet. He is a historian from Spain, a leading human rights lawyer. And he was there on that day in 1977 when the 100,000 Catalans called for Juan Antonio Samaranch to step down. He doesn't speak English, so we're joined by our friend Walter Krockmal, who will translate for him. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Josep Benet.
Bienvenidos a Democracy Now!, Señor Josep Benet.
Hi, we're just going to ask you to speak up so that we can hear what you say. And my first question is, can you describe that day in 1977? And why the calls for Samaranch to step down?
Sí, primero, señor Bennett, le vamos a pedir que hable fuertecito para que podamos captar su voz. Y vamos a pasar a pedirle que describa ese día en el 77 en que las multitudes pidieron la dimisión de Juan Antonio Samaranch.
Bien. El año 1977.
In 1977.
Era el momento en que se haya un cambio importante.
Was a moment of an important change.
En que se pasa de la dictadura del general Franco.
In the transition from the dictatorship of Franco.
A el inicio de un régimen auténticamente democrático.
To the beginning of an authentically democratic regime.
Mediante unas elecciones.
Through
libres,
the channel of free elections.
Que redactaron y aprobaron una constitución auténticamente democrática.
Drafted and improved an authentically democratic constitution.
Constitución democrática que reconocía el Estado español,
which
se convertía en una monarquía democrática,
which recognized the Spanish state and a democratic monarchy. Adelante.
And tell us what happened on the day that you were one of the leaders, actually, of the protest, and Juan Antonio Samaranch's significance.
Díganos qué pasó ese día de la protesta de la cual usted fue uno de los dirigentes que se dirigió a pedir la dimisión de Samaranch.
Bien. En aquel momento nosotros queríamos que todos las instituciones fueran, tuvieran un origen democrático.
At that moment, we wanted all institutions to be to have democratic origins.
Es decir, fueran hubieran sido elegidas en elecciones democráticas por el pueblo.
For them to be elected through democratic elections carried out with the participation of the people.
Y el cargo que tenía el señor Samaranch en Barcelona era presidente de la Diputación Provincial de Barcelona, era un cargo que procedía de su nombramiento franquista.
And
por
the,
lo tanto, no lo podíamos aceptar de ningún modo en aquel momento.
And the position that he held, which was president of the provincial Diputación, which was a Francoist appointment, was what we had were objecting to.
Por tanto, pedíamos su dimisión. Como pedíamos la dimisión de todas las personas que tuvieran cargos procedentes y elegidos por el régimen franquista.
We were asking for his resignation and for the resignation of all people who had been appointed under the Franco regime.
And what was the response of Juan Antonio Samaranch as 100,000 Catalans called for him to leave?
¿Y cuál fue la respuesta del señor Samaranch ante el pedido de 100,000 catalanes de que dimitiera?
Bien, en realidad, él no dimitió, pero hay que reconocer...
In fact, he did not resign, but we have to acknowledge...
Hay que reconocer que dio facilidades para que la Diputación Provincial de Barcelona fueran modificándose las cosas...
But he did bring measures about that democratized the provincial Diputación to some degree.
Samaranch, que era un hombre muy inteligente y de una gran habilidad, se dio cuenta que el régimen del general Franco, el régimen dictatorial, que la dictadura estaba ya, tenía los días, estaba terminando, y que se iniciaba un régimen democrático, pues modificó su conducta y se adaptó rápidamente a este régimen democrático. Esta es una característica de Samaranch, saberse adaptar a las circunstancias, y lo hizo perfectamente.
He was an intelligent, skillful man, and he realized that the days of the Franco dictatorship were numbered, and that it was the beginning of a democratic regime. So he did something which he is very good at. He adapted, and he did so to perfection.
Let me ask you, Joseph Bennett, last week, Juan Antonio Samaranch defended Franco, interestingly enough, once again in a news conference, and talked about how he had industrialized Spain and expanded the middle class. How would you describe Franco and what he did?
Bueno, la semana pasada, señor Bennett, Juan Antonio Samaranch defendió a Franco en una rueda de prensa, atribuyéndole que él industrializara Cataluña y que expandiera la democracia. ¿Cómo responde usted o cuál es su reacción ante esa defensa del señor Samaranch?
Pues creo que el señor Samaranch dijo algunas cosas que no tienen nada que ver con la historia.
I think Mr. Samaranch said certain things that have nothing to do with history.
Creo que en este momento, en esta contestación, no hizo uso de su gran habilidad.
So at this point, I don't think he made use of his considerable skills.
Sino que manifestó algo que él sabe positivamente, que no es exacto.
Rather, he manifested something that he positively knows is not quite exact.
Right now, Spain is calling for the extradition of Pinochet, responsible for the killings of perhaps 3,000 Chileans. How many people was Franco responsible for the murder of?
Ahorita se está pidiendo la extradición de Augusto Pinochet, que se responsabiliza, a quien se responsabiliza de la muerte de aproximadamente 3,000 chilenos. ¿Cuántas personas españolas murieron bajo Franco?
Pues muchísimas más.
Very many more.
Dejando aparte ya la guerra civil, que como toda guerra civil,
not counting the civil war, which like all civil
wars, víctimas, inocentes,
had,
de un lado y otro,
had Franco, a great number of victims on both sides.
Franco presidió la represión de la posguerra.
Franco presided over the post-war repression.
Es decir, que la posguerra, Franco no intentó de lograr la reconciliación entre todos los españoles, de un lado y del otro.
In the post-war period, Franco did nothing to try to integrate the warring factions in Spain.
Sino que, para consolidar su dictadura, hizo una represión tremenda mediante consejos de guerra, es decir, ante los tribunales militares.
In the wake of his dictatorship, he carried out tremendous repression through his military councils.
Y fueron docenas de miles de personas que fueron fusiladas.
And there were
docenas de miles, muchos más que
dozens of thousands of people were shot, were lined up and shot, many more than under Pinochet.
Y lo más curioso,
and the
hay que tener en cuenta, es que todas estas sentencias de muerte que imponían los tribunales militares,
is that all these death sentences imposed by military tribunals,
todas ellas, antes de ser ejecutadas,
before they were carried out,
tenían que ser aprobadas por el propio General Franco,
each and every one had to be personally approved by General Franco,
que firmaba su conformidad con la sentencia.
He was the one who signed his consent to these sentences.
Con una palabra, que firmaba enterado de esa sentencia.
And the word was, I acknowledge or I
así,
give my consent
será,
to the sentence.
Y así será el caso que probablemente General Franco es la persona que ha firmado más sentencias de muerte en la historia, porque
and so the case is that Franco is the person who has probably signed the most death sentences in history, not unlike Stalin and Hitler.
Well, on that,
Hitler y Stalin dieron órdenes para matar a cientos de miles de personas.
Hitler and Stalin
pero nunca firmaron
gave orders to kill hundreds of thousands, but they never personally signed these sentences themselves.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Joseph Bennett, for joining us, speaking to us from Barcelona. Human rights attorney and historian, remembering Franco Spain as we talk about Juan Antonio Samaranch, Joseph Bennett, in that crowd of 100,000 calling for the resignation of Juan Antonio Samaranch from the regime of Franco. When we come back, we'll go back to Craig Capetis of the Wall Street Journal and talk about how this plays into the current IOC scandal. We'll also speak with a historian of 20th century Spanish history. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with Craig Capetis, reporter with the Wall Street Journal based in Paris, who's been doing a series of pieces on the International Olympic Committee over the last year, more than half a dozen front-page Wall Street Journal pieces, the most recent one focusing on Samaranch and his fascist past, which led the head of the International Olympic Committee, Juan Antonio Samaranch, last week, to hold a news conference where people thought he would be dissociating himself from that past, but instead he praised Franco and talked about how he industrialized Spain. And what else did he say, Craig Capetis?
Well, he said three things, which he's repeated often. He said that Franco kept Spain out of World War II, which I'm sure the people of Guernica would beg to differ with that, among others.
Explain what you mean when you say the people of Guernica.
Well, Guernica was bombed by Nazi bombers. Basically, Spain was used as a bench test for Hitler's military might during World War II. And Franco, you know, was an ally of Hitler, and there were quite a few deaths in Spain because of World War II. They were not officially part of the Axis, but I think that's stretching history a little bit to say that Spain was kept out of, that Franco kept Spain out of World War II. The second thing he said was is that Franco created a middle class in Spain. That's also, from what I understand, a fairly specious analysis of history. And the third item, which is perhaps the most curious of all, is he said that Franco appointed the King of Spain, Juan Carlos. What's interesting, if you look at the history, at the time, Juan Carlos was thought to have been a buffoon by Franco and all of the people who wanted him appointed within the Movimentito. It was a surprise to Franco and everyone else. Had Franco lived, it would have been a great surprise to him to see how the king turned out, that he was a Democrat, and he pushed for democratic reforms. But what's even more interesting is that at that time, there was a scramble in Spain when Franco appointed the king. There was a group there who wanted the Duke of Bourbon to ascend the throne, and one of the heads of that group was Juan Antonio Samaranch. And the way Samaranch apparently wanted it played out, he talked to Franco about having Franco's daughter marry this fellow. And because of this, it would perpetuate the line. And Franco didn't want any part of this, and Samaranch was on the outs with Franco for a time because of his posturing to get this Duke of Bourbon to be the king of Spain, who he also had a claim on the throne. As far as you know, what this all means for the IOC right now, I personally think it's pretty much in the sponsors' hands. It's as long as the people who pay the money to keep the Olympics going decide that they want to keep Samaranch in power, well, it's going to stay that way. And right now, there certainly doesn't seem to be any move within the corporate corridors of America to push Samaranch to leave.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. As you write in your Wall Street Journal piece, once again, Samaranch finds himself an icon of a system and an era that's under siege. Today, as scandal and criminal investigations roil the IOC, Samaranch is being buffeted with calls for his resignation, this time from groups ranging from athletes to members of Congress. Last Thursday, he testified before a House Commerce Subcommittee. Sitting at his side was the former Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, and I've heard him since a number of times defending Juan Antonio Samaranch. Is he being paid to do this? An interesting choice to defend Mr. Samaranch.
I don't know if he's being paid. I do know that the IOC is paying or has contracts and has budgeted approximately a little over $5 million with the express purpose, according to documents that were or leaked to us, to wash Samaranch's reputation. And this is all being managed by the public relations firm Hill & Knowlton. It's also clear that the expenditure of this money and other monies during the scandal has outraged many IOC members and many athletes, particularly the athletes, the most of whom, you know, struggle for any kind of money to support their training. There's also been a number of public polls done over the past few weeks. Perhaps the most interesting is one done by Sports Illustrated, where 82% of the people they have polled say the reforms have not restored the IOC's credibility. And the IOC is so much interwoven with Samaranch, I'm pretty sure that that's a public, certainly sounds like a public mandate against Mr. Samaranch's reign there.
Well, let's talk about the reforms. He was being questioned by the Congress members about the reforms that were just approved by the IOC. Among the members of Congress who questioned Mr. Samaranch was Democrat from California Henry Waxman, who complained about Samaranch accepting a $1 million donation from NBC for an IOC museum he was pushing, as NBC obtained the Olympic TV contract without bidding.
Well, let me tell you something about the Olympics. You see, the Olympics are actually a good thing, the whole competition and whatever. And on the surface, I mean, a lot of corporations, some involved with the Olympics, some not involved with the Olympics, gave money. And in NBC's defense, NBC knows how to throw the Olympic Games. They've been doing it for a long time. And I don't really think that the other networks really wanted a piece of this. The only other network that had shown any interest was Fox. But Fox's deal would have required pay-per-view, and that's one thing that the IOC, and including Samaranch, never wanted. They want these broadcasts on terrestrial TV so everyone can see them. What's happened here is this ripple effect, is that the hypnotic trance that the Olympic Games have had for Americans, in fact, everyone around the world, that's what's been shattered here. You know, because the IOC is a story of image and imagery, and clearly stones left unturned. And what this scandal has shown is the dirty underbelly, you know, of the IOC. And that they continually, and again, this isn't me speaking. You can see this in the memos and interviews with them, that they continually put their own self-interest in front of the athletes. And that's where the problem is here. I have seen no evidence of collusion between, you know, NBC or any other network or any sponsors and the IOC. If anything, privately many of the sponsors just wish Samaranch would go away. But he won't until July of 2001. And that is, from what we understand, pretty much a reflection of the internal politicking that's going on there as to who's going to succeed him as president of the IOC. Because, frankly, if he steps down, then all of his cronies would have to go with him because he appointed them. And it's his cronies on the executive board, which really runs the Olympic Games, who are all in contention to succeed him in July of 2001.
Can you talk about some of the people who have come under fire on the International Olympic Committee, some of the people that he has defended, and where they come from? People like General Francis Were Nyangweso of
Well, there's a whole list.
Uganda.
Yes. Well, this is pretty clear, again, from our interviews with people who are experts in this. Samaranch has used the IOC as a reputation laundry for some fairly nefarious people. The gentleman you mentioned from Uganda who was involved with Idi Amin. We also have a number of Eastern European dictators. We have a gentleman from Indonesia by the name of Bob Hassan, who was very involved with the ruling family down there in Indonesia, the Suhartos, involved in owns many of the companies that were involved in the logging disaster down there.
Lee Kun Hee, chairman of Samsung Electronics.
Well, no, that's another fellow who
found
is
guilty
Lee, yeah, Lee,
on charges of bribery.
Yeah,
in South
Lee.
Korea.
He was found guilty on charges of bribery in South Korea. The list goes on and on. It's a very long list. We're not talking about two or three people here. We're talking about perhaps dozens out of the hundred and some 110 people who are on the IOC. And then there's also another substrata of agents who helped the cities get games, a number of international brokers in the oil business who Samaranch has been friendly with, involving certain deals that were under investigation. Elf Aquitaine oil company here in France, for one, Samaranch was apparently involved in setting up some deals in Uzbekistan with this gentleman by the name of Andre Gelfi, who was now wanted by police here in Europe. Samaranch may be questioned in that as well in the future, although it's not certain yet. It's this very opaque institution, and what has a lot of the athletes upset publicly, and more sponsors upset privately, is this the man you want running an organization whose foundation is goodwill, harmony, ethics, and righteousness. And I think at this point a lot of people are just kind of waiting for 2001 to come, but I also get the impression that that's going to be a longer wait than many people think, because there's more investigations going on into Samaranch and his background and these other IOC members. So he's, despite his performance in front of Congress, he's not done taking hits, and neither is the IOC.
It's interesting that Juan Samaranch testified through an interpreter in Congress, although he can speak fluent English. Is that right, Craig Capetta?
Well, that's true, but again, the backstory here, I think, is more significant. Samaranch's English is fine. If English wasn't my first language, I certainly wouldn't want to go up against a U.S. congressional hearing in it. But where he benefited there was, unlike Europe, and this is critical, the U.S. Congress does not have simultaneous translation. We just heard it on your own radio station, where in Europe at the IOC and the UN you have simultaneous translation. This took up a lot of time. It ate up a lot of time, and it prevented congressmen from asking the kind of questions and doing the kind of probing that's necessary. And translation experts can explain this to you, because what they did was, the question was asked in English, it was translated into Spanish, response in Spanish, translated back in English, and on and on and on. And this ate up a lot of time.
Also meant it probably wouldn't get a lot of mainstream coverage.
Exactly. And this was plotted out. I mean, the people in Lausanne were jumping for joy over the fact that the United States Congress is not equipped for simultaneous translation, like the IOC is in Lausanne, or the United Nations.
The New York Times had an interesting piece by George Vesey, the sports writer, at the end, saying he was asked a question. Juan Samaranch, when he walked out of the hearing, answered perfectly in English, but not when he was inside testifying. But since we don't have much time, I wanted to ask you, in a thumbnail synopsis, for people who aren't following the IOC scandal, can you explain what happened a year ago and how it was revealed, the Olympic Committee's corruption?
television station in late November last year was leaked a letter saying that the son of an IOC member received a scholarship in allegedly in return for his vote to support Salt Lake City. A couple of weeks later, IOC member Mark Hodler of Switzerland, who's also the head of the IOC Finance Committee, walked out of a bathroom at Chateau Vidi, where some reporters were waiting for him to discuss this, and he said that corruption was rampant within the IOC, and that's how it started. Right there, corruption and vote buying, gift giving, sexual favors, you name it. And that's basically what opened it all up.
I want to go back one point on Samaranch and bring in our last guest, although we just have a minute, but it would deal with a number of issues we deal with continually on Democracy Now! Charles Powell joins us from Madrid. He's a professor of 20th century Spanish history and politics at the Ortega y Gasset Institute in Madrid. As we look at Pinochet, the possibility of being brought to trial in Spain for crimes against humanity, do you think there's a chance? I mean, it was very difficult to get people in Spain to speak against Juan Antonio Samaranch. Do you think there's a chance that people like Juan Antonio Samaranch, who don't have to be extradited to Spain, they're from Spain, could perhaps be brought up on crimes against humanity under the Franco regime?
No, there is no chance whatsoever. Not least because Juan Antonio Samaranch was never directly involved, to my knowledge as a historian, in any act of repression. He was never directly in charge of any police forces which would have been involved in this sort of activity. And although he was quite an important figure as president of the Provincial Council of Barcelona, this was not the sort of post which would have entailed direct contact with this type of issue. So it's not just extremely unlikely, I think it is totally unlikely that this would happen.
But today, trying to speak to people in Spain about Juan Antonio Samaranch, and even overall about Franco, do you find it unusual that we had a great deal of difficulty getting people to speak frankly about the past?
I do find it unusual, actually. I don't think that's terribly common. Most people in Spain today don't really know much about Juan Antonio Samaranch. You must remember that he ceased to be a public figure here
but
at
I mean
national level.
About Franco overall?
No, I think most people speak quite candidly about Franco overall. You know, opinion polls are conducted almost on a yearly basis about people's views on the regime and so on. And books are being published practically every month of the year about the Franco regime, books which are widely read and bought. So, you know, I don't think there's any sort of reluctance. There may be a lack of interest. I've often discovered in my classes that young people aren't very interested in the past, in the recent political past.
I often find that that's usually because they don't know a lot about it, and especially...
Indeed.
Right.
Indeed. And this is a major shortcoming of the Spanish educational system. In fact, until quite recently, even history undergraduates didn't really have an opportunity to study the Franco regime in depth.
This
probably says more about academia in Spain than about the politics of Spain. But, you know, I mean, it's thousands of books have been written about the Franco regime, about the Civil War, about the transition to democracy. To some extent, I think people are beginning to get slightly bored of the whole thing.
Well, Charles Powell, we'll have to have a longer discussion another day. Professor of 20th century Spanish history in Madrid. Also, Craig Capetis, thank you for joining us, reporter with the Wall Street Journal. You've been doing a superb job on covering the IOC, the International Olympic Committee. Well, that does it for today's program. I want to remind you we'll be bringing you a listener's century on December 30th, a look back at the year, our listeners' view of the most important issues, people, and events of the last century. We'd like you to call in and share your views at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. And let us know what you think about the 20th century. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. You can write to us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!